Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
With all the news on the coronavirus, one could almost forget there are still Brexit negotiations taking place, among other things, to find out if the United Kingdom can obtain an adequacy decision from the European Union. Is the UK data protection legislation enough to offer an essentially equivalent level of data protection? What are the British views on using and protecting personal data? What about national surveillance? And how does this all tie into the life and work of a privacy consultant? That and more will be addressed in today's episode of our podcast. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. Today, I have the absolute pleasure to bring to you, for your listening enthrallment, Ralph O'Brien. He is one of the consultants to TrustArc. He has been here for a long time, and he is phenomenal. So he's based over in the United Kingdom. You may have heard Ralph and probably have heard him on various webinars we do and education sessions. He's very, very active in the IAPP. Frankly, he's just phenomenal, and I've been dying to have him on the show for a while now, so I'm really glad you were able to squeeze us into your calendar there.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And you do know, the first question is not about you. It's about an unexpected personal question, and I had a really good one here. I'm pulling it back up. It is, fame or money?
Well, as a privacy professional, fame is the absolute antithesis of what I desire.
Because there's no money?
Yeah, it's the absolute antithesis of what I desire. I can't think of anything much more hurtful than to live your life in the public eye. And I mean, I both admire and have got the absolute admiration for those people who manage to spend their lives with a celebrity status with the media following them around. Not my cup of tea at all.
And you, Paul? I know you're so materialistic. It's all about the money.
It isn't really, but it also isn't about fame. I don't think I want to choose between these two.
Oh, Paul is not liking my questions lately. I'm going to have to get away from the this or that version. Okay, for myself, I will say that I do have a daughter that is starting medical school, so I'm going to be completely selfish here and say right now it's about the money, but I don't know how I'm ever going to accomplish that.
You maybe shouldn't have gone into privacy.
Yeah, we might be in the wrong career.
Exactly. People in privacy are here for the passion. We're not here for the money. If it's about the money, we probably wouldn't be doing it. We'd probably be at some big law firm doing litigation, right?
That's the most likely. Criminal law also apparently pays very well, but yeah. I'll stay with the passion for the fundamental rights and the greater good.
Just funny you should say that. I've recently been updating my biography. It's
Any ulterior motives there, Ralph?
Purely just to try and, I found it was filled up with all of this sort of corporate speak and wanted to make it more relatable. And you know, the opening line is now passion for privacy. That is the opening line. Communicating my passion for privacy and hoping to inspire the next generation of privacy professionals. How's that for a...
Hear, hear. So where is your passion coming from, Ralph?
That's a very good question. How did I get into privacy? It was a weird and long road. I don't think anyone grows up sort of, thinking, I'm going to become a privacy professional when I'm older.
Maybe nowadays they do, but...
Yeah, perhaps. For me, when I was younger, I actually wanted to be a policeman. And because I was fairly academic, I had parents who decided, I actually grew up on a farm. I'm a farmer by trade. My family were like, you're fairly academic. You're not going to be a policeman. You've got to be a lawyer. No, you're not going to be a lawyer. You're going to be a judge. No, you're not going to be a judge. You're going to be a Supreme Court judge. You know what I mean? And it wasn't until I was actually at university doing law that I actually went, what the hell am I doing here? Believe it or not, I'm a bit of a runaway. I actually ran away and joined the army. Doing communications.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, doing communication security. So it was after communication security when I ran away from that, when they sent me somewhere hot and sandy, that I joined local government. Somebody saw law and communication security on my CV back in the late 90s when the Data Protection Act was coming in the UK. Said, go away, do a course. I went, all right. I went away, did the course and fell in love, you know, and I've been in love ever since. And especially starting the public sector, ironically, I actually ended up working for the police. I ended up working for the UK police at the time of the Bitchard inquiry, where two young girls were killed by a man called Ian Huntley. And the way the public sector shared information was really brought into account, because in the UK at the time, you could pretty much move across the country and disappear. Because the police systems didn't talk to each other. It was not like now. It's not like the surveillance society we live in now. It was almost quite the opposite, with manual records, systems locally, nothing connected. So a lot of my early work was about connection versus separation. It was about the needs of the many compared to the needs of the one. Helping to set up what was at the time the CRB, the Criminal Records Bureau. And, you know, when you can vet someone and how you can vet someone and when you should share information with the police and others. So, you know, I've really got that in my heart, sort of that needs of the many versus the needs of the one, public need versus the needs of the individual. And I've watched the last 20 years of sleepwalk further into that surveillance society. So I think privacy is more relevant now than ever has been. In fact, I would say as our right to privacy diminishes, the importance of data protection law increases.
That is fantastic. And I realize I say that a lot, but over the years, Ralph, what would you say is the most dramatic change that you've seen?
Oh, well, change is a constant. yeah, I mean, you know, when I first started out, we were writing memorandums on bits of paper. My first boss got an email system and a computer and printed out her emails and put them in her intro. I remember it very clearly. And change has been a constant.
Wait a minute. Did you just say intray? Do you realize that probably the majority of professionals out there, you know, a little younger than me, probably have no clue what an intray and an outray is? I mean, I'm just saying.
Imagine your email client inbox as a tray on your desk, filling up with paper.
And imagine how full it gets.
This is to do with snail mail, right?
Yeah, snail mail. Or inter-office memos, as it was back then. But yeah, I mean, the connection of the internet. I mean, as we've gone on, we've been gradually connecting more and more things. You know, you could say that first of all, we connected computers. And then with social media, we connected people. And now with the Internet of Things, we're connecting devices. We're connecting sensors. To me, the rapid rate of change is like that sort of exponential curve. And the way I often describe privacy and data breaches is it's like comparing, you know, the amount of damage you could do with a stick to a sword and the amount of damage you can do with a sword to a gun and the amount of damage you can do with a gun to a nuke. You know, as technology has increased, the potential good and the potential, you know, the good, the nuke, the gun, the bomb, they're not bad things. Their technology is neutral. You know, it's what you do with it. It's the human that counts. And as we are growing, we're consolidating, we're getting bigger, we're more globalized. Companies now, you know, are bigger than countries. All of these things mean that the capability for harm and the capability for good equally is that much greater. So I think what really changed for me is the scale. You know, I've gone from looking at a filing cabinet and an individual's record to looking at algorithmic decision making that affects entire global populaces.
Do you think that we, society and our legislatures, are doing enough to protect ourselves against all that interference, all that surveillance?
Yes and no. Everyone's been talking about the 2-year anniversary of the GDPR recently. I personally call it the 4-year anniversary. It was passed in 2016. You know, that's 4 years now of a new piece of legislation that was supposed to, you know, fix everything. And as I said, data protection law is supposed to be that sort of almost balancing act where you, you know, where if you don't have a right to privacy, you know, the organizations have an obligation to protect your data. And we've been looking a lot at the GDPR success or failure. I personally am concerned with the lack of enforcement. I personally am concerned with a lack of regard for basic human dignity, especially when we start, you know, pulling huge amounts of data and making decisions by algorithm. You know, we forget it's people's hopes and dreams and loves and hates and desires. And, you know, even on a 99.9999% accuracy, there'll still be individuals we discriminate against, right? So to me, I think the human is often forgotten, and I think that enforcement has been poor. I think there are some reasons behind that, the poor enforcement. I think, as I said earlier, business is bigger than country now. Company is bigger than country. And we have the ability for organizations to act globally with huge amounts of resources in making decisions that affect huge amounts of people. And our national regulators can't compete with the funding, can't compete with the fines, can't compete with the complexity, you know, literally don't have the resources to make the necessary decisions. And so I think instead of relying on the stick, instead of relying on the enforcement, we've got to start talking about more of a data ethics line, more of a convincing these companies that it's in their own good, their own competitive advantage, to go beyond the law, go beyond data protection law, go beyond the human right to privacy, and start thinking about, you know, the human, the putting the human at the center, actually the advantages that could have for them in terms of customer loyalty and data management, and really look at data protection as a positive thing rather than a legal requirement, perhaps. That was a really long answer to a really short question. I'm so sorry.
No, but it was a really good answer. As you were describing that, you made me start wondering, well, is that applicable to the GDPR across the board for the countries? Is there a different approach in the United Kingdom? I mean, you know, we're going to get to Brexit or something.
Here it comes. But
let's leave it at GDPR. Do you think that there's a different approach the UK has taken that the other countries or some of the countries in the EU have
yes.
not?
Yes. And I'd probably, even without Brexit, I'd lump the UK and Ireland together here. You know, it is a stretch of water in between us and the continent, but actually psychologically, I think it's a little bit more than that. Everybody knows the right to privacy in the Europe, you know, is developed as a fundamental human right as a result of World War II. You know, everybody knows that. But actually, I think the UK and Ireland have got a lot more in common with the US sometimes because of a shared language and a shared culture. Especially in the US approach to privacy has historically been one of consumer rights rather than fundamental human rights. You know, it's been one of commercial interest as opposed to human interest. And to me, I think if you look at the Irish and the English regulators, they've always been somewhat business friendly. They'd like to say balanced and temperate.
Despite all the controversy around that.
You know, certainly if you compare, say, the Irish regulator to a German regulator, even though they've got the same piece of legislation to work with, I think you'll find the German regulators much more keen to make punitive decisions against organizations.
Which of the 17 Germans are you speaking about?
Well, exactly, yeah. But, you know, so certainly some of the decisions they've taken, you know, banning smartwatches for children, you just never see here in England and Ireland. I'm very frustrated, you know, with the ICO's position on ad tech, for example. You know, you should really make a lead and make a stand on such things, whereas the ICO seems to be in an eternal position of inviting them in for consultation and tea and cakes. You know, rather than taking any sort of punitive or enforcement action. I mean, you know, they say we're trying to understand what they do, but come on, it's been 20 years now. You know, we've had we signed up to Convention 108 in 81. We've had a Data Protection Act since 84. The principles have not changed. And I can only see, actually, unfortunately, in the UK, the situation getting worse post-Brexit. We've already seen Michael Barnier come out in the last couple of weeks, talking about the different negotiating positions of the EU versus the the UK, the UK perhaps being unwilling to commit to human rights post-Brexit, the UK being unwilling to commit to keeping those standards of adequacy to EU law because they are concerned about sort of marketing themselves as a tax haven, a data haven in a post-Brexit scenario. And, you know, one of the things, you know, that was obviously key to their Brexit agenda was to get away from European rules, if you like, and be and, you know, have some sort of more domestic variation. I don't think that's going to go well, especially if they, on the other hand, want to ask for an adequacy agreement, want to ask for an international adequacy agreement. It's, you know, the way I've often described it is it's like trying to take candy from a baby in fact, more accurately, spitting in someone's face and asking them for a loan, you know?
What's your real opinion?
You asked me to be forthright. I'm just being forthright.
These are known to be unscripted conversations. We have proven this is unscripted.
So, Ralph, now that you have mentioned the B word, and you've also already referred to the comments made by Michel Barnier just a few weeks ago, what is the feeling currently in the UK on adequacy? I mean, all the negotiations probably have moved very much to the back burner because of COVID-19, but is there still any confidence, any hope, maybe I should say, that there will be an adequacy decision? Or is everybody just accepting the fact that there won't be any agreement by the end of the year and that it will just be a hard Brexit after all?
Well, let me just get out my crystal ball.
That's why we have you on the program. You have a crystal ball, right?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to apologise for butchering Michel Barnier's name. You've just put me to shame there, Paul. I apologise. Looking at things through my English eyes, I'm afraid. God, Brexit. Do we see an adequacy agreement ever happening? I mean, you could argue it's a political necessity for continued trade. And, you know, if something gets in the way of a continued trade, countries find a way. But I think the UK is on a little bit of a... I mean, I don't want to reveal my political opinions too much, but a little bit of a self-destructive agenda. I believe if you've got, a world that is increasingly becoming global, you know, companies and brands and cooperation also needs to become global. We've also seen increasing resistance to that and increasing sort of nationalism and increasingly xenophobia. It's almost like a counter wave to the globalization and togetherness that we've seen in the world over the last, 20, 30 years. You know, I personally believe, if you want to make change, you come together. If you want to make change, you try to change from within. That's my political opinions. To answer the question on adequacy, I mean, who knows? The UK government's agenda makes it look less and less likely. But in order to have some sort of, trading arrangement in the future, that makes it a practical economic necessity, especially if you've got to do things like, make sure that, strike down SCCs in the courts, I mean, what'll be left? What'll be left? It's a kind of it's a crazy, crazy time. And
true that.
It might be good for, consultants, and whilst it might be good for law firms, I think my ultimate concern is what it does to the common individual, right? What it does to the common man on the street, the common woman on the street, and ultimately what it'll do for sort of, human dignity in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, I've always likened privacy to a helping profession. Unlike a lot of attorney specialties, privacy still looks out for the common man.
Yeah, and it's funny enough. I've been doing IAPP training today. I've been doing a CIPM and CIPE training this week.
Woo-hoo!
And a lot of the people I've trained, I've been training the gaming industry, the gambling industry in Malta, and a lot of those conversations we've been having is about putting the individual at the center. Privacy by design, PIAs, where organizations are not used to looking at risk to the individual; they're looking at risk to the business, right? And so this idea of putting the individual at the center, thinking about humans, not in terms of bits of data, but in terms of hopes and dreams and loves and hates and desires and wants, it certainly doesn't come easy to a corporate machine.
No, and they're having to face it a lot more now with COVID-19. Not that this is going to turn into a pandemic conversation, but a lot of companies are having to look at privacy measures now when maybe they've never, ever had to look at them before, despite whether they lived in a region that has strong privacy laws like the EU or not. I think it's going to be interesting to see what else comes out of this new conversation of privacy for many corporations.
Well, this is what I love about privacy. This is where my passion really gets stoked, because privacy's in everything. Data protection's in everything. I mean, this COVID situation, you know, we're home working, we're remote working, we are sharing more data than we ever have been through remote devices, yeah? We're really seeing glimpses into each other's homes and houses. The line between business and personal has never been more blurred. We have tracking apps being mooted and being launched by government. We've got citizens' rights being put aside in the name of the greater good, right? This is, you know, with the tracking apps, you know, looking at the DPIAs that have been released on them, looking at centralized or decentralized apps, looking at the response of people like Google and Apple going into business together
the first time since forever.
These are strange times, but you know, something like COVID, you know, it's got privacy in its DNA,
right? Literally,
that's very true.
Yesterday I was actually on an IAPP knowledge net, virtual knowledge net, with Ann Cavoukian, and one of the things she talked about was the Apple Google partnership and how she has met with Apple multiple times. They walked her through the entire infrastructure and data flow and how they're protecting data. She's a huge fan of it.
Yeah, funny enough, I am too. I wouldn't normally say I'm a fan of Google, cut me through the middle, you'll probably find an Apple logo there. I mean, Apple have taken a huge, you know, memes, whether they're just roaring about it or they actually do it. You know, you look at the Apple advertising campaigns that puts the individual in privacy. You know, they say, hey, we're going to be bloody expensive, but bloody hell, will we fight for you? You know, I love that, right? But I love their decentralized model. I love the fact that we're saying, hey, it all stays on your phone. Whereas actually in the UK, the UK NHS COVID app, guess what? A centralized model. Government has all the data. And to me, there can only be one reason for that.
Right.
You know, what else are they going to do with it? How long are they going to keep it?
But I read that the UK government said it is a voluntary app. Unless not everybody installs it, then it becomes mandatory.
I mean, I haven't read that. I haven't read that. But you are right. For such an app to be effective, you're going to need 70-80% of the population downloading.
Right.
Right.
Does 70-80% of the population have a smartphone capable of doing this?
Well, I mean, you know, we live in a modern society. You know, we've got 9, 8, 9, 10-year-olds walking around with smartphones capable of having the apps on them. So
true, but if I look at my parents' generation,
yeah, of course, yeah, I don't see you're ever going to get to that 70-80%. It might be a huge waste of time. In fact, actually, as we're starting to come out of lockdown, in a way, you know, it might be useful if we get to that sort of second spike, perhaps. I hate to say it, but my cynical mind just looks at the data grab. I read the DPIA and it's real lipstick on a pig stuff.
Well, I mean, at least the DPIA is public. That's already
well, right,
a start.
True. And that's not something we would do here in the US.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, they start off talking about, you know, the fact they're not going to collect personal data, and then, you know, 3/4 of the way through the document. It's just like, you know, it looks more like a PR document than a DPIA.
Well, what about the difference between the UK and the French consideration of their contact tracing app? Any big differences you see there?
I will firmly admit a knowledge gap here, and I haven't looked very closely at the French app.
France is like a lot of other governments. They want to run a contact tracing app, but they want to do it without Apple's privacy scheme.
Yeah, it's France and the UK that don't want to use Apple and Google's underlying technology, whereas the rest of Europe seems to be willing to give that part the benefit of the doubt. Also, the rest of Europe is looking at using decentralized technology if they are going to use apps at all, because also that has not been decided in every one of the member states. I know here in the Netherlands, it is an open source development project, so all the development is done via GitHub, so anybody who has an interest can apply to get access and monitor and see what's going on after a first disastrous appathon where companies could pitch their ideas and show what they have done. And one of the seven companies in the appathon was already found to have a breach during their presentation of the app that they created.
Well, do you know what? I've got an appathon story that you've just reminded me of, and it's the most beautiful story. I'll have to find the link for you, Paul. I got involved. I don't normally do a lot on Twitter. I'm more of a observer than I am a poster. I'm a lurker, yeah, fine. You know, it's perhaps the privacy part. You know, it doesn't mean I'm still not a voyeur. somebody retweeted or brought to my attention an app that they were doing, and it was around education. It was an appathon. It was, as you said, Paul, it was a load of students getting together, and they were these tech-savvy students, and they were encouraged them to build an app. But the nature of the app they were building was an app that would monitor students' attentions.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea, it was a COVID...
What could possibly go wrong there?
Yeah, it was a COVID app, and the point was... let's monitor whether the children are looking at the screen,
you know, looking away for longer than 30 seconds. Problem there.
And I usually went a little bit ballistic. I was kind of, you know, and I'm not a Twitter troll at all.
Okay, what's your handle on Twitter? I gotta go find this.
At IGR O'Brien. But you'll just find, you'll find mostly retweets, unfortunately, you know, not too much original content. I pretty much, like, not realizing that it was actually a group of young adults. It was, thinking that it was older professionals. And I kind of said, you know what, kids have got enough to deal with. Why normalize the surveillance society? They're all stressed about COVID anyway. Some children, it's bad enough even trying to get them to sit at a computer, you know what I mean? And, during COVID, and, you know, yes, of course, I want children to be educated and educated well, but, this is your computer staring at you and marking whether you're looking at it or not. You know, everyone learns differently as well. People learn by listening, people learn by doing, people learn by drawing. And I went on a little bit of a tirade. What was really lovely was a few days later, I'd forgotten about it. A few days later, I got messaged by one of the young ladies involved on Twitter, and she'd written a blog. And the blog was kind of like lessons learned, you know? And it was, unfortunately, I felt for them. It was like a load of professionals ripped into me on Twitter. I felt really disheartened. I felt like, you know, I was scum of the earth. I felt like, what the hell was I doing? And I thought, oh no, I've done this to some other person in the world. I feel awful. But then she said, but actually, do you know what? We went back to the drawing board and said, why are we doing this app? You know, and we actually did a survey. They actually put out a survey saying, what barriers are there to your child's education at home during COVID? And the response was bad internet connection. That was the problem. Not whether they were paying attention. The biggest problem they had was the internet going out. And they was like, well, let's design an app that helps with that then. You know what I mean? And it just goes to prove sometimes, you know, with technology, we don't often ask whether we should. We ask whether we can. We come up with this idea. And this is where I think we go beyond the law again, go into data ethics. We go beyond the right to privacy, beyond data protection law, and into data ethics. When we start asking ourselves the question, not whether we can do something, but whether we should, right? And for me, they've developed a completely different solution. You know, they hadn't understood their customer. They hadn't done the research. They hadn't said, why are we doing this? What's the real need here? And they came up with something that was nothing to do with privacy and surveillance. It was, you know, a completely different question.
But that is really interesting. And you've mentioned a few times now the surveillance society. And that reminds me an awful lot of the work that I did when I was still with the Dutch DPA, when the former Police and Justice Corporation within the European Union was part of my portfolio. And I recall that in the summer of probably 2013, the Washington Post released a whole series of stories, Top Secret America, about 90,000 people having the highest level of clearance in the United States on access, including lots in private sector companies, being able to monitor the behavior of people, to monitor what they were doing online and offline. And I know that when we were doing, when we were looking at those reports and they came out in the midst of summer, when everybody could pay attention over maybe 10 days or so, every day a new story like that. And we wrote quite a lot of reports on that for the Article 29 Working Party, and also did some opinion pieces for the Dutch media, together with my commissioner at the time. And that was a year before Snowden. So when the Snowden revelations hit on the front page of The Guardian in the summer of 14, it was like, okay, we're going to have the same summer all over again. It is all going to be about surveillance, and we need to find ways to put a stop to this. Then we got to the annulment of Safe Harbor in 2015, following the Snowden revelations. And it was the same discussion all over again. Until what point can the state interfere into our daily lives? And until what point can private sector organizations interfere in our daily lives, monitoring everything we do on an ongoing basis, often without us even knowing that it is happening? And we thought we had given good recommendations and found some sort of approach at the time that the European Commission could work with. And then, of course, we got the Cambridge Analytica scandal. We are now 7-8 years down the line, and I don't think we have learned any lesson yet.
No, we don't. I mean, I think as privacy professionals, it's tempting to shout, privacy is dead, let's all go home. You know, I feel like I've been I've been fighting the rear guard of a losing battle for the last 20 years. I mean, you know, my own personal story on that, I was part of a police committee in 2001 that looked at number plate recognition,
ANPR.
ANPR, exactly, yeah. I wasn't sure whether the abbreviation was international, but yeah, ANPR, yeah. And we, and the ICO got round the table with the police, and they agreed it just after September the 11th, 2001, to create a ring of steel around London, as it was called at the time. A one-off, they said, number plate recognition, such a dangerous surveillance tool that it can only be, you know, as an anti-terrorism provision, be used as a period for 1 year to create a ring of steel around London. Now ANPR is...
We are even using it to find the advisor of the British PM, right? To see whether or not he went for a drive.
Yeah. Every petrol station forecourt, every parking garage, yeah. You know, and the actual original ring of steel cameras is now the London congestion charge zone, ironically.
So you need to pay to be monitored.
It's that sort of function creep. It's that sort of scope creep that, you know, once you open the doors to something, you know, it's a Pandora's box. Privacy is always a Pandora's box. Once something is known, it cannot be unknown. Once the damage is done, it's done. You know, once the floodgates are opened, it's opened. And yeah, you know, people have been saying privacy is dead when the camera was invented, when the television was invented, when the internet was invented. But I think where we're wrong is we look at it as a binary system. We look at it as a yes or a no answer. The problems I've seen with all of these COVID discussions about the app, for example, is it's privacy versus public good, right?
Right.
I'm sure Anne Kavoukian would have said this on your webinar, Kay, is that it doesn't have to be a negative sum. It can be a positive sum. It can be a win-win. it's the principle of the thing of privacy by design, isn't it? It's win-win, right? The idea that people look at privacy as a negative cost to their business, as a law that they've got to comply with, to me, is the biggest sadness that I have. Rather than look at it as this is our way to win business, this is our way to win customers, go through the privacy principles. Get rid of data you don't need anymore. Make sure the data you've got is...
Bite your tongue.
Yeah, make sure the data you've got is accurate. Don't get more than you need. I mean, is this just not efficient ways to run a business? You know, you can turn...
Be honest about what you're doing.
Y'all are going way too far now.
Too far.
I know. It's a far-fetched statement. Yeah, but
I mean, to me, these are just good practices, right? This is a way to do good business. To me, it's not privacy versus business. It's not privacy versus public good. It's privacy and public good. To me, if your right to privacy is gone, then data protection law is your savior. You know, data protection law is what makes your organizations deal with data in the most effective, efficient way. It's not your barrier to good business. It's your route to good business. And this is, I know I'm talking in sound bites here. But
only because you see me writing them down.
But this is, you know, if I'm talking to senior management, you know, and I had this for all the way through the GDPR, especially, you know, companies coming to me and saying, hey, Ralph, you know, I've got this problem. How can I make it go away by the 25th of May? And I'm like, man, that's when the problem starts. You know, you've resourced a problem and, you know, I had people whose projects ended on May the 25th.
Wow. Well, I've heard about companies where they hired a DPO and said, well, that's GDPR solved.
I mean, for a start, May the 25th was a Saturday and I was in the cinema watching Solo, a Star Wars movie. I mean, you know, that's how concerned I was. You know, Monday morning, the ICO wasn't going to turn up knocking on your door. And I feel really sorry for CEOs and MDs that were sold like, oh, 20 million euros, 4% of global annual turnover, masses of subject access requests. The world's going to fall in on Monday. You know, right now, I'd be feeling very, very peed off, right? Because I was sold it as a stick, as a bad thing that's going to hit me if I don't do things. That's blackmail. You know,
who's to blame for that? Is that companies? Is that the bad consultants? Is it the media? Is it the regulators? Is it just the people not doing their job in reading what GDPR was all about in the first place?
I mean, GDPR, again, when we reflect back on the last 4 years, as a mixed bag. I mean, you know, you could argue that we've never had greater visibility of privacy and data protection. People are more aware of their rights, companies being more transparent. You know, when I talk about privacy and data protection at a dinner party, people know what the hell I'm talking about. People want to contribute to the conversation. They don't tell me to shut up anymore. It's brilliant.
True. Yeah. That was different 6 years ago.
Yeah, they tell me to stop being so boring. This is the fascinating, visceral stuff that affects all our lives. And, you know, people really love to get on board with that. But on the flip side, you're right. The marketing and sales engine got involved. There was money to be made out of GDPR. There were things to be sold. There were new technologies to be created. And there were silver bullets to be sold to companies, right? And yes, I think as a privacy profession, as a sales and a marketing profession, as companies, we've also got to take ownership of the fact that we may have perpetuated some of those myths, that we may have, in our efforts to, you know, move organizations further along that maturity model, perhaps with good intentions, you know, we may have perpetuated some of those myths ourselves and encouraged that sort of quick panic buying. Let's fix a problem. Are you compliant? Yes or no behavior, rather than the through life evolving programs and the sustainable privacy management that we should have been creating.
Exactly. It's a way of life, not a graduation ceremony.
Superb. You're speaking in sound bites now. That's amazing. I'm going to write down yours.
Okay. Final question is for you.
Usually I would say, is there anything that when we asked you to come on here, you wanted to make sure that this one piece of information you had to share? But I'm actually, and if you want to go there, we'll go there. But I think I'm going to take a page out of Paul's book and say, specifically, because people are very, very interested in the UK, specifically, what do you see in the near term future for the UK?
It's funny, you just reminded me at a conference a year back, someone asked me, you know, what my closing comments were, and I said available at reasonable rates and dropped the mic, you know. but perhaps that's a bit too self-moving on. What do I see in the short and medium term for the UK? Oh, God only knows. Let's get out of lockdown first. We are moving our lives increasingly online. You know, this has only contributed to that, you know. We are living our lives increasingly online. The blurring between our business lives and our personal lives has never been so blurred. You know, we used to have very clear distinctions. And I think now, you know, with our online personas, and, you know, I used to try and make it very clear in my life that, you know, what was business and what was personal. And I encouraged a business persona online, but you know, we would try and hide a personal one. And, you know, that's increasingly difficult to do. Everything's connected now, you know. So I think against that backdrop of a technologically advancing society and an evolving society, my hope for the UK is that, I mean, you know, I think I'm resigned to the fact Brexit is going to happen, whatever. I'm going to stop sulking about it. But my hope...
No, you're not.
But my hope is that we could use it as an opportunity to be better, that we could actually, instead of, you know, being limited, we could perhaps open ourselves to this idea that, you know, we could open to the world, perhaps we could open to globalization. We could perhaps come up with any sets of laws or amendments we make aren't at a detriment to individuals' human rights. You know, if I were to send a message to the government at the moment, it's, you know, please, please, please remember the individual. You know, it's please, please, please remember that. Remember that, you know, individuals have hopes and dreams and, you know, economic prosperity, you know, there's also got to be social harmony and social prosperity as well. And, you know, by safeguarding people's mental health as well as their physical health and their data. It's funny, whenever I finish a training course, I always put up posters that you get from the gambling and the drinking industries. And all of their adverts say exactly the same thing. It's, you know, it's you know, please, please, please enjoy responsibly. You know, please drink responsibly. Please gamble responsibly. And, you know.
But do drink and do gamble.
Well, yeah. I mean, whether you think they're a good thing or a bad thing is another thing. They're just things, you know. And therefore, I always finish my training courses the same way. I say to people, you know, please, please, please use personal data responsibly. You know, please, 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 you know, don't not use it. Don't stop what you're doing, but, you know, make sure that you put the individual into what you do. Make sure that the individual is at the heart of what you do and their hopes and dreams and conditions. That's what's important in life, you know, and if COVID and isolation has taught us anything, it's that people are important. And, you know, I personally miss people, you know, I miss a hug, you know. And for me, you know, putting the person at the center of what we do and, you know, in the short term and in the long term in the UK, if we can get better, more inclusive and, you know, think about the individual as a society, then, you know, the world is going to be a better place. Let's face it.
Splendid. Thank you so much, Ralph. And that wraps up another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us. Don't forget to subscribe to Serious Privacy in your favorite podcast app, so we land automatically in your feed of new programs. And should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter at @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as EuropolB. Thank you again for listening to this week's Serious Privacy. Until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.